is a world of wonders. There is a giant rift in its surface 5,000 kilometers long. There is a volcano as wide as Arizona. In our time, we have sifted the sands of Mars. We have established a presence there and have fulfilled a century of dreams. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located in London, Ontario, Canada, at a distance comparable to the length of Kasai Vallis from our own terrestrial channeled scablands. It has been said that we know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the 70% of the surface of the Earth covered by water, and for good reason. While all other planets have either one or no presently functioning assets on the surface or in orbit, on Mars we have five. As such, our ability to interrogate the planet's surface and atmosphere, to monitor seasonal and diurnal changes, and to test our theories about the mysteries of this place rivals even the knowledge of our own Earth in some respects. And what a place! As Carl Sagan lists in his opening quote, there are features on Mars that are truly phenomenal. But Valles Marineris and Olympus Mons are just the beginning of the Martian story. Helping to unravel the planet's past and what its future might hold is planetary geologist and Western University adjunct professor Livio Leonardo Tornabene. He has had the good fortune to work with data from three of the spacecraft I alluded to above, and it is this breadth of knowledge about the planet built up over a decade of study that has allowed him to make his discoveries. Before coming to Western, Livio worked with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter's high-rise camera in Tucson, and in homage to this work, I have selected Arizona as tonight's music. I sat down with Livio in his office to speak with him about his work with the Red Planet. So I understand, Livio, that you've worked on a number of space missions. What does that entail?
Well, I was fortunate enough to get involved in space missions early on as a graduate student at the University of Tennessee, where I did my PhD work. I started there in 2001, which was right on time for the Mars Odyssey, which was just going into orbit later that year. I was fortunate to come into this program where there were a number of faculty, and two people in particular, Dr. Hap McSween and Dr. Jeffrey Mersch, who were my co-advisors on my PhD dissertation committee. And they were both collaborators or co-eyes on the Themis mission, which was on board the Mars Odyssey. So that was my first taste of a mission. And there was a lot to learn. Basically, I was thrown in the pool, which was quite all right. At least at that level, I wasn't involved so much in the day-to-day activities with respect to running a mission. That came later on in my experiences. But I did learn a lot about how a mission operates with respect to what the science team does and how it interfaces with the mission and what inputs it gives into these planetary missions. I should probably back up and say a little bit about what Themis is. Themis is an acronym which stands for the Thermal Emission Imaging System. And it is comprised of both a thermal infrared camera, which can view the Martian surface both during the day and at night. And it also had a visible camera on it, which, if I remember correctly, had five filters on it, looking at different wavelengths, including visible wavelengths, so you can make color images with it.
I see. So this is a little bit like the Mars Observer camera, but it covers a bigger area, right?
Yeah, basically the thermal infrared camera was able to get a image with a width that was about 30 kilometers across, and the visible camera was able to get about 20 kilometers across, and the resolutions on both those imaging systems is 100 meter per pixel and 18 meter per pixel, respectively.
I think a lot of us, and maybe a lot of our listeners, have seen visible images and color images from the surface of Mars. What can you do with a thermal imaging camera that goes beyond what we can do with three colors?
That's a great question. And of course, one of the great things about being involved in a ongoing and presently operating mission on Mars is you're on the threshold of discovery. I was very fortunate to make an interesting discovery with respect to impact craters on Mars, and that's my area of expertise, is impact cratering as a geologic process. But as far as the features themselves are also interesting in data sets. Thermal IR is particularly sensitive to the physical characteristics of the surface. So during the day, the surface gets heated by the sun, and at night, it retains some of that heat, and it cools down, and it cools down in such a way that it's sort of a function of the surface characteristics. So, for example, I grew up in Florida, and I spent a lot of time on beaches, and so I often use a beach analogy to help along here. Often, if you've gone to the beach, during the day, the sand is quite hot. And so when you're making your way to the water or back towards the parking lot or the sidewalk or whatnot, you just get to a certain point where you're like, the sand's too hot, and you try to make for either the water or you make for a sidewalk. And so the analogy here is that finer materials during the day, they absorb heat and they lose it, that heat, that is, they lose it over the period of the day, either slowly or rapidly. And in this case, for fine-grained materials like sand, you would lose that heat more rapidly over the course of a day. So it's releasing a lot of heat, and you can feel that. Whereas the sidewalk, on the other hand, it loses that heat more slowly, and so it's cooler. And that's during the day. And because it loses that heat slowly, at night, they sort of flip around temperature-wise. So the sidewalk would appear warmer than the finer-grained sand.
I see. So you can tell how big something is, whether it's fine-grained, whether it's coarse-grained, or whether it's a boulder, by looking at night and seeing how hot it is. It's almost like all that extra mass gives it a kind of inertia.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, that's that's what we call this property where heat is either retained or lost slowly as a property of that material. And that's called thermal inertia. So that's where thermal IR or thermal infrared images are particularly useful, and that's why we want to take them both during the day and night to see this sort of changing behavior in the surface temperatures to tell us about the physical constraints of the surface. So grain size or whether you have bedrock or rocky materials is certainly one of the characteristics that you can pull out of this data. And so one of the things that I was fortunate enough to come across on Mars are RAID craters. And RAID craters are significant because, for one thing, we didn't think they existed on Mars. RAID craters are craters that are extremely fresh, they're young, and as such, they have really fine materials that have been ejected during their formation, and they go for long distance, and they often look like sort of radial spokes emanating, like on a tire, for example. You have like these radial elements coming out of this crater, and they go over hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometers, which is many times the diameter of the crater itself. And so they're very characteristic, and of course they're well known on places like the Moon, and Tycho is probably one of the best examples that you can actually see with the naked eye, and if you have a pair of binoculars, even better. And essentially, this characteristic of rays is a sure sign of this crater being really, really fresh. So essentially, it's been well known that these craters are on airless bodies, such as the Moon and Mercury and some of the icy satellites. And so at one time, it was believed that if you have any atmosphere whatsoever, it sort of inhibits the formation of these rays, since they are far-reaching and they travel great distances from the primary crater that forms them, and the atmosphere was once thought to decelerate the ejected material, and so it wouldn't get that far. And so, yeah, once upon a time, it was thought Mars doesn't have these things, and it was because we were looking invisible wavelengths, and they don't have a very apparent visible signature, whereas the ones on the Moon and Mercury and the icy satellites do. But on Mars, it was the thermal IR that was key to seeing these things, because the rays are made up of very fine particles, and so they're very cold at night, and you're able to see them contrasting with the surrounding warmer surfaces on Mars that we see at night.
That's interesting. And I know that we can get an idea in the visible as to what kind of material makes up a surface. I mean, it may only be three colors, but can identify rusts and tell it different from a basalt and different from other things. Does the thermal IR and IR spectroscopy from THEMIS, does that give us more information about mineralogy?
Yes, so that was another aspect of THEMIS. It was able to look at 10 different wavelengths across the thermal infrared portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. In that range, there are basically sensitivities to not just the physical properties of the surface, but also composition. And so another great aspect of using THEMIS data was using it to find surfaces that had distinctive compositions. And so another part of my dissertation work was using craters as a probe of the subsurface. You know, you have small bodies impacting the Martian surface, and it may potentially expose something beneath the surface that contrasts with respect to the composition of the surface. And one of the neat discoveries recently on Mars, which comes from another instrument, which I'll talk about here shortly, is HiRISE, which is a pretty much a super resolution camera, visible camera, on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And we were able to image really, really recent craters that are really small, and so they're more frequent as far as debris remaining from the creation of the solar system. There's a lot smaller pieces remaining, and so you have impacts that form craters that are on the order of tens of meters in diameter occurring more frequently. They can occur on the order of months, and over the course of several years of imaging with HiRISE, we've been able to see many of these features. And the real exciting thing that we found was that at higher latitudes on Mars, some of these craters in fact revealed subsurface ice that would only last for a short period of time, and we were able to image them subsequently with HiRISE and see that ice fade over time. So we were able to essentially prove that it was ice, indeed ice, that was being exposed by these craters.
I see. So you can actually probe that ice table without having to have a specialized instrument to look for ice. You can just do it with the impact craters that are happening every few days.
Yeah, it's really novel way of using craters as nature's drill, essentially, because as a geologist on Earth, if we don't have the rocks that we want to investigate exposed at the surface, we often utilize drilling technology to drill deep into the subsurface and basically extract a core, which is a cylinder of rock that we would cut out and bring back up to the surface and analyze that instead. But since we have not yet gone to Mars, we have craters to provide us a glimpse into the subsurface. And besides that, we just have Martian meteorites to help us understand the formation and geologic evolution of the Martian surface.
So it's interesting that you mentioned meteorites, because there are ones from Mars that come to Earth, but there's also things that land on Mars. And one mission that's certainly seen a lot of that is the Mars Exploration Rovers. And I've heard that you also had a role on that mission as well.
Yes. Yeah, so towards the end of my stay at the University of Tennessee, I was able to also, through Drs. Hap McSween and Jeffrey Mersch, they were also involved with the Mars Exploration Rovers, which was a twin rover mission, Spirit and Opportunity. And Opportunity is operating to this day, investigating 20 or so kilometer diameter crater Endurance, which is pretty exciting for someone like me. And I'm no longer involved with the rovers, but this is just the sort of thing I would have loved to have been around for. But as such, yeah, I was able to get involved in what was nominally a 90-day mission, which of course has gone well beyond that. The mission started back in 2004 and was supposed to be 90 days. And of course, here we are in 2012. And although Spirit is no longer operating, I think it's just been over a little year since that's happened, and Opportunity is still going. And so we're looking at 8 years compared to 90 days.
It really is quite
phenomenal.
Remarkable.
Since the mission kind of went longer than anyone anticipated, graduate students were encouraged to be involved at pretty much any level of planning. That was extremely exciting, and it provided something that I didn't have with Themis. Sure, I was able to sit at my laptop and say I would like a target taken somewhere in this box, but it was quite something else to be able to be involved with a rover, which moves across the surface and is there and looking at the surface in exquisite detail, almost like what a geologist would be doing on the surface. And often these rovers are referred to as robotic geologists. And yeah, it was quite exciting to be able to try out various roles and be able to say where the rover should go and to a certain extent and what it could image and what targets were interesting and even name a few rocks on Mars, which is kind of fun. So
that's some neat stuff. And you've got quite the resume there. I mean, we started with Odyssey. We talked a little bit about MIR, and you mentioned also an instrument called HiRISE. This is on MRO?
Yes, so that came later, after I completed my PhD work at University of Tennessee in 2006. I did a postdoc at University of Arizona under Dr. Alfred McEwen, who's the principal investigator for the High Resolution Imaging Science Experiment, which is what HiRISE stands for, and we've talked a little bit about this instrument, and this by far was my deepest involvement in a space mission. This is where I was hired on not to only do science as a science team member, but I was also very much involved as an operations. In fact, my title was a HiRISE targeting specialist. So on any given day, I would be responsible for interfacing with a science team member and basically planning a 2-week campaign of imaging. And these things operate 24/7, and you try to fill as much of the data volume that you're given with respect to covering as much as Mars as you possibly can with a high-resolution imager. The higher resolution you go, the tendency for the image size to get smaller. And I mentioned Themis before, having its 30 and 20 kilometer width, and HiRISE is down to about 5 to 6 kilometers across. So you're getting much smaller stamps on the Martian surface. So it's pretty much nigh impossible to cover the entire planet at about 25 centimeter per pixel. And that essentially enables you to resolve things on the order of a meter in size.
So it's kind of like a spy satellite for Mars.
Supposedly, there's higher resolution for Earth, but the tendency is, unless you have permission from various governments running these things, you can only get about 60 centimeter per pixel. So as someone operating in the public, you're getting higher resolution from Mars than you could from Earth, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is pretty neat. Now, as part of your crater work and as part of the work that you've done in terms of working with these orbiters, I know that you've been involved with the naming of several features, and I'm sure our listeners would be very interested to know how you get a particular name attached to a feature on a planet such as Mars.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, because I had the extreme privilege to name one of the raid craters I discovered through the Themis data set after my dad's village in Sicily. And the name of that crater is Grateri, which is G-R-A-T-T-E-R-I. Basically, the IAU, which is the International Astronomical Union, they are a group of people that basically help delegate how things such as naming features on planetary surfaces should be treated. And so there are conventions for naming things. We don't just give random names to things such as craters on planetary surfaces. So we try to be consistent, and we try to be fair, too. And this convention is particularly for Mars. For craters on Mars, and these are for craters that are below 60 kilometers in diameter, the naming convention is to name any crater in that size range, basically from 60 kilometers on down, after towns and cities anywhere in the world that has a population of 100,000 or less. And this is just a convention they came up with. And basically, if you find a crater of considerable scientific interest, you can submit a proposal to the IAU. And there's not a lot that goes into these proposals. Basically, you just have to prove to them that it's worthy of naming, and then you can sometimes even suggest a name, which is how I was able to get one of my craters named Gratteri. Some of our listeners may have heard a number of years ago about how Pluto got demoted as a planet. This is the same basic institution or agency, the International Astronomical Union, that is sort of in charge of these sort of great debates in planetary science, and so they were the ones that were responsible for that demotion of Pluto. But that's another topic, and that could be a whole show on its own.
Well, as they say on astronomy.fm, this is the network where Pluto is anything it wants to be. So with that, I'd like to thank you for speaking with me today. Fascinating interview, and we hope to have you back on again sometime.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you, John.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to the interview with Livio Tornabene talking about his experiences with various space missions at Mars, particularly struck by, once again, the value of having a variety of sensors at different wavelength bands. You can't see everything with your own eyes, even if you could put them there.
Right. I mean, one of the things he was talking about was looking at these rays from these craters, which you can't see with optical instruments, right?
They're very visible on the moon.
Right. I mean, you look at Tycho.
Tycho crater, you can see them a bit with the naked eye. Certainly a pair of binoculars will draw them right out. There are rays that seem to cross halfway across the disk of the moon. These weren't thought to be there at all on Mars until they turned an infrared instrument on them.
Mars has many surprises still. That's why we need to look at every wave band, every available resource.
Is there an explanation for why we don't see the rays visibly on Mars? Or is this still a big question right now?
It might be that there is. If I were to give an explanation, it would be extremely speculative. I think the answer actually is just that it's probably due to composition.
Yeah. It's probably just they're the same color as the rest of the dirt. Not the case on the moon.
Yeah.
Clearly on the moon it's very bright when you bring up this material from underneath the surface, but I guess on the moon or on Mars, that's just not the case.
And it wasn't just composition as well. It's the size of the particles, right? It's pretty amazing that from a satellite we can learn about the size of the grains on the Martian surface.
It's surprising the different kinds of things you can learn. If you come at it from, for example, a mineralogical background, you see differences in composition and you may not see anything else. Differences in size, differences in shape, differences in density and arrangement matter. When we heard from Carl Mitchell from JPL about the radar instrument on Cassini, they were looking at the surface of Enceladus, and they knew it was ice. But when they turned the radar on it, they found such a bright return that it had to be ice that was organized in a way that they couldn't understand yet. Learning to think outside one field, compare mineralogy to morphology to geology and geography, there's always more information to be had.
And it's amazing because it's all from one mission. You know, one mission with a few different devices on it, but nonetheless, this is one satellite that can explore the Martian surface and can look at so many different issues, so many different fields of research, so many different topics, show us things we didn't know, probe many different things that we're interested in. So there's the upcoming Martian mission that was recently announced called InSight, which is to land on the surface and then actually physically dig into the surface. It's very interesting that this satellite is able to actually do something like that, do the precursor to that work from space. And it really proves that in science, we really go the extra mile to get all the value we can out of these missions, each mission, to learn everything we can, even things that people would think, with a satellite, how can you possibly learn about subsurface water? But we can do it.
Yeah, and that kind of remote sensing tells you a lot of things if you're willing to look at the whole electromagnetic spectrum. And that requires you to make decisions about what kinds of instruments you can build and which ones need to be sent. What I found particularly interesting, though, is that we have now mapped so much of Mars with this series of orbiter missions.
1 meter resolution, he said?
He's talking about 60 centimeters. So with that high a resolution, so first of all, that's fantastic. I mean, we have a data set that, I mean, there's areas that have been imaged that still haven't been looked at in detail. But the fact that we've covered the whole planet more than once and that they can now target for re-imaging of certain areas means that Livio and company can go and look at areas where there have been changes. They can see new craters forming, and they can see surface processes happening. And so we actually can see the present evolution and present surface processes on Mars.
And the indication of subsurface ice is extremely exciting.
That is very cool, yeah. you know, we've had these images remotely. We had Phoenix, which also had its own way of showing that. The idea that we can get current updates. Now, we don't just have a snapshot of the planet as a static thing, but we can see it evolving. I think that's really neat.
Yeah, I think it was really exciting to hear about the ice and the fact that with these multiple snapshots, you can actually see that it is changed and that it is evolving and there are processes, and you can track that and learn a lot about the water component.
What's nice about the announcement of the InSight mission as well is that people are thinking, well, do we know everything about Mars? Should we go on to somewhere else? But it's nice that they're kind of saying, you know, hey, there's still a lot more we don't know. Why don't we just try to keep studying these areas and seeing what else we can find out?
Yeah. Yeah, there's always a lot more. We're still not really sure about the water component. To be able to actually dig physically, that's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot more that it's going to do, of course, as well.
The other thing that's interesting with Mars, I mean, it's famous for sort of eating spacecraft. Something like half the ones we send there don't make it.
Right.
But lately it seems that the ones that we have succeeded in sending seem to really outlast their predictions. Not just the rovers. Yeah. Yeah, not just the rovers on the surface, but Odyssey from 2001 is still operating. It was used as a relay for MSL's landing just a couple weeks ago. And that was planned. That was, you know, they're still relying on this spacecraft after more than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still sending back more images of the kind that Livia is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible bang for the buck.
That is pretty good, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have to continue to support the operations of this thing. One of the costs that is not always foreseen when you're designing a mission, the idea of a decade of operations might not have been budgeted. But when you have a spacecraft in orbit, you can't give up on an asset like that.
Which satellite took pictures of MSL's landing?
Those high-rise images of the... So you can see the actual heat shield and the parachute. That image was phenomenal. That should be the image of the year, I think, when they do that.
Oh, yeah, we can do fantastic. That. We have a satellite taking pictures of other things dropping onto the surface of Mars.
And that's the second time they did that with Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That high-rise camera is, to my understanding, it's not even designed for that kind of work. It's a scanner.
Right.
It does these long strips on the surface. They were able to reorient the spacecraft and program it in such a way to take a picture of the Phoenix landing a few years ago, and with that experience now with MSL.
And that parachute stage of MSL doesn't last particularly long either, so
right.
For the fact that they were able to get that picture is pretty phenomenal.
You know, now that we have, there are several spacecraft operating on and around Mars, the fact that they can coordinate teams at universities and at NASA and even at the European agency to get all the orbiters in a position to be supporting the landing of a new rover, to be acting as data relays for the assets on the surface. We're starting to get, you know, almost as good as operating things around Mars as we've gotten around Earth.
Yeah, and all these tools are so effective and so useful. It really is a bright future for learning a lot more about Mars.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Michelle Parsons, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.